Les colloques du Collège de France.
Yes, and the title is actually changed, but not the list of co-authors. And so, if we think about the strategy for saving the planet from an environmental disaster, most people in this room, most mainstream economists, would hope for the green technology to work. So we become, we incentivate the introduction and, in the spirit of Rilke's contribution, the diffusion of technologies that are environmentally friendly, and eventually we avoid the worst. Now, there is another intellectual tradition that is skeptical about this. It's very much marginal among mainstream economists, but somehow vocal in society. And the idea that actually goes back to the idea of an economist, Georgescu Rogan, in the 1970s, with his theory of entropy law, is that, well, this is gonna never work. The only hope we have is actually to have a significant decrease in growth and perhaps even stop growing. So economists are usually quite allergic to these ideas. We think, for instance, that if that is true, we're never going to win that battle because the cost for society will be so high that in the short run, nobody is actually going to be enlisted. Now, one aspect of that theory, of part at least, is the idea that we should switch the emphasis from quantity to quality. In this paper, we're going to take this idea seriously and incorporate in a mainstream growth model. The idea is that there is actually a spontaneous process in the economy that can help us and on which we could actually ride. And this is a process of structural transformation. Structural transformation, in particular, has two sides. We move towards economies that are more intensive in services and less intensive in goods, and service economies are cleaner, as I will show you. And the other aspect is that part of the technical progress, and an increasing part, arguably, is about quality and not quantity of production, something that we have always known, but we have always thought it was just, you know, something that in the model, in the end, plays out the same way. It doesn't when we think about this problem. Now, a key ingredient of our theory will be income effect and non-homothetic preferences. There will be also part that has to do with the trend of technology. I will emphasize that part less today. So as consumers become richer, the demand of consumption goods moves progressively towards service-intensive goods, something we can see in the data. And also, there is an intrinsic, inherent switch towards quality over quantity. Now, the twist of today's theory is that this will also have an effect on the direction of technical change. Because as the market for quality improvement increases over the market for productivity increase, well, then we will have a switch, and again, spontaneous in part, towards emphasis on quality, and I will argue again, this is going to be beneficial for the environment. So we may have a declining environmental footprint of GDP growth. Now the question is, should we just wait then that this happens? We may not want to do that, because this process may be way too slow relative to the need of intervention. Question number two, I will show you most of the talk in a closed economy, but we are also discussing what happens when you have international trade specialization and physical production move to other nations. And then, you know, general question is, do we really need to degrow? Let me start with the following example that I think has some of the basic elements of our argument. Take iPhone 15, take iPhone 3 back in 2008. The carbon footprint of these two products is essentially the same. It has been actually documented that. Now, if we take the cost of iPhone 3 in 2008 and we, you know, accounting for inflation, we translate it to today, the price is about the same for an iPhone 3 in 2008 as today an iPhone 15. So it may look at some level as if the carbon footprint per unit of expenditure is constant. That's a deceiving conclusion, because there is a lot of improvement in quality, and you know, a back of the envelope calculation, you cannot buy a new iPhone 3 today, but a back of the envelope calculation would be that it's actually 5 times more expensive in quality adjusted terms. So people would be willing to pay about $150 today for a new iPhone 3 if that market existed. So the conclusion that I have drawn is actually incorrect if we think that we are actually consuming a lot more in terms of quality. That's an idea. Now I'm going to show you, now I'm going to switch to documenting two important aspects. First, services have a low carbon footprint. Here we have, we are building on the work of Levison and O'Brien. We have 142 consumption goods, and we use input-output metrics to see, to go to the value-added content in terms of services versus manufacturing the goods. And we plot it against a different measure of pollution intensity. There are a variety, and it's very strong and very stark, the result. So more service-intensive goods have a lower carbon footprint. How much? Well, products whose service content is 10% points higher have on average about 25% lower emission per dollar. And if you see, the range of variation is actually quite high. It's more like in the order of, you know, between 0.1 and 0.8. So there is a lot of difference in consumption pattern. We also document that richer people, as we become richer, we switch our consumption pattern towards service-intensive goods. So there's a lot of potential gain there. In fact, if we just run some cross-country regression, and we look at the service content in terms of, you know, share of manufacturing in GDP, controlling for all what needs to be controlled on the right-hand side, the level of development, population, size, and whatever, well, we have the following picture. A one percentage point employment shift from manufacturing to services, holding constant agriculture, is associated with a 4% reduction in emissions across countries. A similar result all through, if you control for counter-fixed effect, it's a bit smaller, it's about half, and across US counties. So there is also, you know, in this is purely descriptive evidence, of course. Okay, so with these facts in mind, let me present a theory. The theory has the following components. The production side of the economy has two sectors: a manufacturing upstream sector that produces inputs to the production of final goods that are produced in a different sector. The technology to produce the physical good, the upstream, is a standard aggregate CES aggregator, where each of the varieties is uses labor and a technology. That technology endogenously evolves through a standard Schumpeterian mechanism that I won't have time to describe in this short presentation, but that's totally standard. Now we go downstream, and we have a set of, let's say, J consumption goods. Those consumption goods have two important characteristics. The first is that from the point of view of consumer, the value of the consumption doesn't depend just on the quantity consumed, but also on a quality index. So each variety has an associated level of quantity, and the sensitivity of consumers to the quality is specific to each of those sectors. So in some sectors, it may be more important than in others. And again, there is a process of Schumpeterian innovation that improves over time the quality of these goods. So there is improvement in productivity, there is improvement in quality. The second feature is that the production of each of the varieties that, you know, then are aggregated into this J sector requires two inputs. The first is an input of goods that come from the upstream sector that I described before, and the second is an input in terms of labor services. So in reality, when you buy a consumption good, you always buy a bundle of local services, for instance, the person, the shop that is selling the goods in the street, and the goods that have been used to produce the item you're buying. Okay? Now, here, there are two important elements of heterogeneity: the parameter lambda that pins down how service-intensive the production of a particular consumption good is, and the parameter alpha j that captures how quality-sensitive that good is from the point of view of consumers. And then we have a bunch of standard manufacturing and labor market clearing. Here is the key assumption we make. We think of consumption good as based on a sophistication ladder. The sophistication ladder has two dimensions. One is the service intensity. The other is the willingness of consumers to pay a premium for quality. In general, consumers value quality more so in some sectors, in some consumption goods than in others. An example we came up with is pet food versus gourmet restaurants, since we are in Paris. Arpège is a place I visited at some point.
You didn't ask the cat.
High quality pet food.
Yeah.
Yes, but
I have a cat who refuses to eat anything, but the most expensive.
I know, but how much? No, but I'm not saying there is no such thing. Actually, in the US, I will change the example because I know that puts me in troubles. But I promise you that you don't pay a premium comparable to the one of Arpège. It's an empirically sound statement. Okay, so that's the type of correlation. I also want to argue that rich people spend a higher share of their income on the type of goods that are more sophisticated relative to lower income people. Okay, in fact, in the spirit of simplifying the theory, I will only have two consumption goods. A basic good that does not use at all services and is completely insensitive to quality, but that's, of course, a simplification to make my life easy in writing up the model, and a sophisticated good where alpha s is equal to 1, so it's like people buying units of utils associated with quality, and there is a positive share of service in production. That's just for the sake of keeping the math simple. Now, I have promised income effect, so we parameterize non-homothetic preferences by a price-independent generalized linear utility function that Timo has revived. It's the work that goes back to John Muehlbauer. This is a class of utility function that does not allow for an analytical representation, but we can do an indirect utility function representation that I'm not showing you today, again, for the sake of simplicity and the short presentation. What I'm showing you are the associated expenditure shares that you can obtain by way of Roy identity. So the expenditure share of an individual with income E on the basic and the sophisticated good are this expression. You see, if you set the parameter phi to 0, then you have Cobb-Douglas. But then there is a term that captures real income that essentially represents the income effect. As simple as this, in fact, actually, the type of non-homothetic preferences I use, incidentally, for the qualitative argument doesn't matter. This is very nice because we can estimate the parameter in a way that we have done in previous work that is very, very convenient. But, this is the idea. When you are poor, you spend a lot on basic good. As you become richer, you spend more sophisticated goods, and then there is an asymptote. And when we are very, very rich, we are Cobb-Douglas. Then there is an emission function. So emission accumulates over time. There is some regeneration, and the assumption is the emission is proportional to the physical production of goods. Now, it would also allow some polluting role of services. Here I go for drama. And then there is another term there that captures the part that we don't study here, that is like the green technology part. So the technologies may become more friendly over time, there may be regeneration, so we don't necessarily pollute or gross becomes net because we get better technologies. The important thing is that there is a critical level of P that we don't want to cross, otherwise we have what we call environmental disaster. Utility goes to minus infinity. And the final ingredient of the theory is directed technical change. So we have a pool of researchers who can direct their effort either to material production, when they do that, that expands the span of production, or to quality improvements. And, well, the way they do it, the probability of innovation, there can be a tax, Pigouvian or not, and an expected value conditional innovating. Here I'm doing Ernest Liu's trick, and I told you yesterday I wouldn't criticize him because it's only one period. It's a simplification that I hope you will be as generous as I was with him. Otherwise, we can discuss it. It's not essential. So in equilibrium, the share of R&D that goes to quantity versus quality is essentially determined by two things, by policy and by the market share. And the market share on the numerator for quality is expenditure share of the sophisticated good. On the denominator is the share on the basic good plus the share of the sophisticated times the cost share of goods in their production. Okay, here is what happens over time. The employment share of services increases, the employment share of goods decreases. This comes from an already calibrated model. I will tell you very quickly something in a moment. And you see that over time, this structural transformation drives the share of R&D effort directed to quality to an increase. And in the long run, this is what we have. It's just parameter, 1 minus beta over beta is the Cobb-Douglas case. But you can see that policy can be very powerful. So in the long run, we can decide essentially how much growth of pollution we have, because that's a function of the material growth. And we have a new margin for maneuver, which is to use taxation to shift quantity to quality. And will that decrease growth? To some extent, but not very much, because growth in quality should also be accounted as growth. Oh, I won't have time, given the warning I've already gotten, to tell you how we calibrate the parameters. Let me just say that the income elasticity, it's not something we get out of the blue. We use a method that Michael Peters, Tianyu Fan, and I used in an earlier paper on India, and so we estimate essentially those parameters. Okay, so given those parameters, do we need degrowth? Well, it depends. If by growth, if we completely ignore the quality aspect, look at the right-hand side, the GDP per capita growth is actually going down to zero. If we completely account for improvement in quality, we know that we don't. A number of studies have pointed at that. Well, then growth remains pretty high. It's, even for some range increasing. If we account it imperfectly, well, then we have some slowdown over time as we become more quality oriented, and more so the richer we get. So the extent of it. What about emissions? Well, this is just a proof of concept because we haven't seriously thought about what an environmental disaster is, but you can see that emission, which is the flow, and on the right, the pollution, which is the stock, how they behave. They go up, up, and up, but then at some point, the shift towards service takes over. Remember, in the United States, emission levels are coming down since 2008. A lot of that could be green technologies, I doubt. Look at the right-hand side. You see, if we let it go just by its own dynamics, it's going to cross the line. It's, again, a proof of concept. We haven't calibrated seriously that line. I've seen it. But if we do policy intervention, and that policy intervention has a new dimension, punish quantity, favor quality, well, we can get it. We can get it, and the costs in terms of wealth are going to be low. Okay, I have 2 minutes. I won't be able to describe the important extension we do on trade. I hope the discussion will help me. But otherwise, you know, just to tell you that we have done it. So we have an extension in which we have two countries, China and the US, at different level of the process of development, which means that China initially is more oriented towards good, US and services. We open up to trade. That creates specialization, and China goes even more into goods and US more into services. There's something to say about the trade deficit. That's a part I won't have time to talk about. But I want to show you at least qualitatively what happens. So we have an effect of a direction of technical change. Specialization pushes technical progress in the US or in the West more towards quality, but it has, in China, an ambiguous effect, because specialization would push towards quantity. At the same time, there are gains from trade that makes also Chinese people richer. In fact, they are particularly strong for them. So that moderates that, because also Chinese people will want to consume more services. The service share of employment in China is on the increase. The productivity growth of services, sector where productivity growth has been highest in China in the last 10 years, is services, not manufacturing. I have a paper on that. Oh. Here is the net. Again, this is a proof of concept because we don't seriously take into account the gap in environmental friendly technologies between US and China. But you see, in the US, high barriers, it means high barriers, and free trade, it means free trade. So in the US, free trade means significant decline, significantly lower environmental footprint. The opposite is true for China, but it's parameter dependent. I could have shown you a graph where for China also there are gains, but I've chosen this one that is somehow the moderate picture. And you see that on average in the world, we have barriers to growth, reshoring, and all these things that politicians these days like so much are actually harmful for the planet, not helpful. Conclusions. I presented you the sketch of the theory of endogenous degrowth in material production, although quality adjusted GDP perpetually grows. So it depends on how we think GDP. If we have a correct measure of GDP, what people are willing to pay, then it's a model of endogenous growth. If we're thinking about quantity of production, it's endogenous degrowth. Structural change can help our effort to cut emissions. This is not going to be, I hope, a plea for inaction, rather the opposite. The good news is that in this case, policy can ride the wave rather than lean against the wind. So there is a hope, you know, given the social opposition that this type of policy, pro-environment, face these days. Trade barrier, reshoring, reindustrialization. This is a kind of a result that I would take with a bit of a grain of salt because we are still working on the exact quantitative aspect. But we have a strong impression that all of these are bad ideas because through the income effect they generate, they are going to actually end up increasing pollution worldwide. A concern, there is here a dangerous correlation between pro-environmental policy and policy that tend to be intrinsically pro-rich, because we want to help the production of the stuff that rich people actually consume. That's an echo of the result of our earlier work on India, where service-led growth appears to be a great thing in many dimensions, except that when you look at the effect on welfare of people at different positions on the income ladder. That's not so good, because there is another source of hidden inequality that we may have forgotten.
Okay, thank you very much.
I was a bit worried to discuss this paper because Fabrizio and Michael are hosting me at Yale this fall, so I thought, if I don't like it, it's going to be awkward the whole day. It was a great paper to discuss, so thanks so much for asking me to do this. Okay, so starting point. This is a graph. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's spectacular, right? There's been a massive decline in emissions in advanced economies since the mid-2000s, right? So this is for the U.S. If you're looking at emissions, if you're looking at emissions, right, between 2005 and now, they've fallen so much that emissions now are roughly at the level that they were in, say, in the 1970s, right? So there's been a lot of success when it comes to emissions reductions. There's a couple of reasons for this. So a part of it is that some of the emissions of advanced economies have been outsourced to China, but that's actually a minority of this. Right? So there's been a genuine fall in emissions, and maybe we need to tap ourselves on the shoulder a bit more on how good that is. But there is a question of what's driving that, right? What's driving that fall in emissions, and is it going to continue? And I think one of the key questions for that literature is whether it's going to fall endogenously as a result of preferences, or whether you need policy and carbon taxes to achieve a decarbonization. Now, what this paper presents is a theory where preferences can actually cause a decline in emissions. And the idea is that as society becomes richer, demand shifts towards luxury goods. As people get richer, they don't want more of the same. No, they want nicer things, right? You don't now eat 100 breads. You eat one bread, and you eat, and you consume an iPhone. Now, the key thing is that luxury products involve more human inputs or service inputs, as the paper calls it, and that means that the production or the consumption of luxury goods is less polluting than the consumption of manufacturing goods. And furthermore, innovation in luxury goods centers around improving their quality. So over time, a luxury good like fancy restaurants, they actually are getting better over time and not necessarily cheaper or more efficient in their production. Okay, so that means that as the economy develops, growth becomes quality-led. It's good for the environment, but it also means that endogenously there might be more more underestimation of TFP growth. And that's because quality adjustment in price indices is very modest. I think Pete actually has a paper on this in the AER, I think 10, 20 years ago. And the idea is that hedonic price adjustment in price indices is really limited. So for us as economists, whether we're able to produce more utility with an input bundle because the outputs that we produce are higher quality, or because we produce more units, both of that is growth. Both of that is productivity growth. But in measurement, it might look very different because quality growth is just harder. And so one of the nice implications of this paper is that this endogenous move towards quality-led growth might cause a lack of appeared productivity growth purely coming out of measurement. So it's a novel explanation for the productivity slowdown that we've seen in recent years. In one way, I would say this means that we can have our cake and eat it, because for the degrowth activists that say that we should end economic growth, it's great because, you know, in the statistics we can end economic growth. But for us as economists, we don't have to end economic growth because we consider more utility for a given input bundle productivity growth, and that can continue, right? We're just not going to call it economic growth. So it's great. All right. So what did I think of this paper? I loved reading it. It's just a very plausible exercise, right? Non-homothetic preferences are clearly a feature of the world. And in the context of climate change, it means that transitioning to clean production might just be a lot easier or cheaper than you think in a traditional neoclassical type of model. It also offers an additional motivation for loading climate change predominantly on advanced economies. This is already a part of climate policy, right? There's a special role for advanced economies. Usually it's motivated by the fact that we have a stock of past emissions. There's historical guilds, which is maybe why advanced economies should contribute more towards the fight of climate change. But this paper says it's also just very effective, right? Because in advanced economies, there's actually a shift in preferences towards greener production. So it's a very complete paper. The mechanism is very intuitive. That's why I just put it on one slide with a few bullet points. I don't think it needs any regurgitation of the maths. The implementation is rigorous, right? So although I'm putting it in words, it's actually very well done. And there is empirical evidence to back things up. Now, I'm what's standing between you and coffee, and Bronwyn has been strict, so I'll just have two comments. The first is going to be whether emissions are actually declining in the data because of reallocation towards low emission sectors, or whether in the data actually within sector emissions have been falling. And then I'll talk about whether, when it comes to the recent productivity slowdown, this novel explanation is plausible. But the key novelty of this paper is that as countries get richer, you get endogenous degrowth, you get a reduction in emissions intensity of GDP because of a change in preferences. Because preferences mean that we reallocate from a basic sector that is carbon intensive towards luxury sectors that are less carbon intensive. Whether that's happened or not is in the end an empirical question, right? And we can just look at the data, we can look at that decline in emissions that I started with, and we can decompose that decline in emissions into what's coming from sectoral reallocation, so reallocation of economic activity towards low emission sectors, or I can just look within sectors at declines in emissions. I'm going to present a very simple way of doing this. I'm just going to look at broad sectors like industry, transportation, agriculture. It's very broad. I think it fits with what the paper currently presents with the basic sector and the luxury sector. But this is, of course, way coarser than you'd optimally like to do this, right? So I think the exercise that I'm going to propose can be done much better by the authors. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to decompose the decline over time in emissions over GDP in a within sector component and a reallocation component. And the way that these exercises work, so this is the GDP weighted average of emissions over GDP. And then I'm going to sum across sectors, changes in emissions holding their initial shares in GDP constant, or, right, looking at changes in the importance of sectors, right, and holding their ratio of emissions over GDP constant. And then there's a residual term that we usually hope in these analyses is modest. So the paper loads a lot on reallocation, right? That's the novel thing. So if you do this with, so this is actually hard to do because you want to use end users, because the only sector that emits is actually energy, right? So you want to use the input output structure exactly like the authors are doing very carefully. There is UK data on this. The one issue is that this is core sector. So the coarser the sector, the more, of course, you're going to load on the within sector component, right? The more disaggregated the data you have, the more you give a shot to reallocation. So in the next graph, I'm going to show you that in the UK data, it's actually within sector reallocation that is driving most of this. It's not to undercut the paper, it's just to say you need good data on fine sectors to actually validate the mechanism. Okay, so what you see in the UK data, so this is UK emissions over GDP. Like what I showed for the US, they've really collapsed over the last 30 years, right? So this is more than a 40% decline in emissions over GDP. And then you can decompose that into the within sector decline in emissions, reallocation, and this cross term. Now the good news for the paper is that there's both been reallocation towards cleaner sectors, right? But perhaps the less good news is that actually within sector reallocation is very important. That seems to be the first order thing. And one of the sectors that's driving that in the UK is transportation. Right, so transportation is very emissions intensive. It's had a decline. It's become greener over time, but we're also flying more, right? So that within sector decline in emissions is actually very important to get an overall decline in emissions over time. There has been reallocation that is not necessarily towards greener sectors. Now, the paper is actually able to accommodate this, right? Because the authors also allow for there to be a decline thank you very much. Trouble. Okay,
fast.
So the authors have a mechanism in the paper through which within sector emissions can fall, right? So what I think would be a very interesting exercise for the paper is to do this in more disaggregated industries. So I had 7 industries in that graph. The authors have 138 industries, so they can do a much better job, really identify how much comes from reallocation, and then they could actually use their data to quantify the model. They could actually show how important that novel endogenous degrowth channel is as a contributor towards overall decline in emissions. Finally, final comment, Bromin, is there's a decline. So there's also a hypothesis in the paper that quality-led growth leads to growing mismeasurement of TFP growth. And that I find very exciting, because there is a question of whether the recent decline in TFP growth in advanced economies is driven by measurement error. And I think so far the conclusion is no. Right? The reason is partly actually Philippe's and Pete's own work saying, yes, there has always been mismeasurement in TFP coming from, for example, the way that we do price indices, but there's no evidence that mismeasurement has increased. Right? And that's what you'd need to have if mismeasurement is driving the slowdown of TFP growth. A different argument that Chad Siversen makes in his 2017 paper is that mismeasured sectors like IT, they're not particularly large in countries that have had bigger productivity slowdowns, right? So that's also an argument against that mismeasurement hypothesis. But this paper offers a new argument, right? It says actually it's quality-led growth that has become more important, and that's what's driving this slowdown in GDP through mismeasurement. Now, if you look at the data, it is hard to find evidence of this yet. Right? And that's because if you look at the slowdown of productivity growth, is what I'm plotting on this axis, against the level of per capita income, actually the countries that have had the worst slowdown of TFP growth as of yet are actually the richer economies. Right? So if you contrast the explanation of this paper for the productivity slowdown to, say, the rise of intangibles, right? It's my personal favorite, or other explanations for the slowdown of productivity growth, There's a question of whether you would expect, right? So if luxury goods are driving this growing mismeasurement, it is questionable whether you would expect to see that in the poorer countries first, or whether there's something else going on. Again, what these comments mean, right? They don't affect the narrative of the paper. It's original, it's rigorous. So I think it's a phenomenal paper. I think where my comments really matter is how quantitatively large is endogenous degrowth. Right? Is this a potential mechanism that is going to become more important over time? Or is the bulk of this decline in emissions simply that we've become better at producing in non-polluting ways? Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.